speaking clock. Hi, it's Helen Hebert, and I'm in LaPorte, Indiana with Andrea Peterson at her home and studio. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Helen.
What are we? It's April 6th, 2016. It's a rainy, gray day on the farm, but that's good for the plants.
That's very good for the plants, for our recently planted fruit trees.
Awesome. So I met you at Dudonnet. We both worked at Dudonnet. What year did you come there? I was already working there. 93 or 94?
Probably 94, since I graduated in 93 with my master's, and then I came the following year. So I think 94 we met.
Okay.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Okay, so then, tell me about your master's, because you studied paper.
I did. In those days, Helen, there never was really a paper college,
right,
so to speak. So we all know that. So, but when I applied for graduate studies, looking around schools across the United States, I was looking for people who had an interest in paper, and somehow, so when I was applying, it was to either a sculpture department or a printmaking department or a fibers department, because whoever was interested in paper at that moment would have brought paper to their department.
So let's back up. How did you get interested in paper?
Oh.
First of all.
Well, when I was doing my understudies at the School of the Art Institute, actually, even before that, I took a few classes at a university in Wisconsin before I decided to continue in art, fine arts. I was actually playing the French horn and making artwork, and I went to a few professors in Oshkosh, which is where I was at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, and I was in the orchestra, and I was in the fine arts department, which is, both are very demanding fields, and I just had a conversation with each department head about my work and or my playing, and I definitely got the more positive response from the fine arts.
I didn't know you played the French horn.
And that really made my decision to go to the School of the Art Institute. And then I figured if I was going to go into art, which I was doing fairly well where I was, but I felt I could be challenged in a much more intense way. So then I applied to the School of the Art Institute. And while I was at Oshkosh, I had no idea about Appleton, Wisconsin, which was merely 20 miles away. And it didn't even occur to me. I was there for a very short amount of time. I was only in school there for a year and a half. So when I applied, then I went to study. When I was at Oshkosh, they brought in a speaker who had mentioned handmade paper and the idea of handmade paper, and being someone who draws on paper and prints on paper, I was always very frustrated with materials and that marriage to paper, mm-hmm, and how it wasn't really always very satisfying. And so being someone who likes to create my own objects, I decided, well, I'm just going to make my own paper. And after numerous disastrous results, I then decided that I should just put it on the back burner for a while, and I moved. When I went to the School of the Art Institute, lo and behold, in the fibers department, they had a hand paper making course, and I taught by Rick Hungerford, and I said, this is my course. And I took it, and it just really opened my eyes. Instead of merely just making the paper as a substrate for my artwork, it was the artwork, and mm-hmm, that just fit my thinking and the way that I worked. And I love process, and that's really what paper is all about the process. And so I was able to take that class repeatedly and become very, very excited about what I was doing, that I wanted to continue those efforts in graduate school with my printmaking. So in the understudies at the School of the Art Institute, I became very fascinated with drawing, printmaking, and paper. And with those three, I continued on into my graduate program.
And where did you go to graduate school?
And so I went to the graduate school at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And there, the paper program was conveniently in the printmaking, which is one of the decisions that made me want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 3-year program, which I found very successful. It's interesting when I see grad students doing a 2-year program, I feel like they're just getting somewhere, and that third year really takes them into the professional level. But So I was there for 3 years, and then I got a position with the university as a director of a small arts program on campus. And then I actually got a phone call from Marilyn Sword saying they were looking for artistic assistant at DuDonné.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of happened very quickly, and I found myself that spring in 1994 in the summer, I don't even remember. It was a whirlwind. That summer of 94, I was definitely on my way to New York and thought I had the dream job. I had the dream job. That was a dream job.
Right.
So, you know, being able to get paid for something that was really near and dear to me.
So describe what you did at DuDonné.
Well, DuDonné, I think I did a little bit of everything. I mean, at the time, it was such an amazing crew. I think back on that, it was Mina Takahashi, Paul Wong, Helen Hebert. And, you know, for the most part, that was the heart of the of DuDonné during those few years. And it was, I was on the wet floor with Paul. So we basically either assisted artists, made pulp for people, created stock paper lines, invented new ways to get things drier when the basement was damp, all sorts of things to keep the roof over, the roof over the studio, so we could keep continuing doing what we're doing. And it was very exciting. Unfortunately, I was really only there for a year because I got another amazing job offer to teach at Columbia College in the book and paper program through interdisciplinary arts through that department, and with Suzanne Cohen-Lang. And at that time, Marilyn Sword was the director of Columbia, the Book and Paper Center in Chicago. And Suzanne was my chair of the department, and she took me on, and I started teaching there.
Right, and your partner, you weren't married yet, right?
Was John and I
still back here?
He was still, yeah. So, well, when I moved to New York without him, and then we realized that we couldn't be apart. And so when I moved to Chicago, he moved to Chicago from Minneapolis. He is still in Minneapolis throwing pots, and he had built a kiln, and so he was firing that through and making sure that, you know, everything worked out for that situation that he was in. And then we both moved to Chicago for a few years, and we were in the city.
Well, tell me about your first date with John, because I love that story. Didn't you, like, skin an animal?
Yeah, we skinned an animal. We probably skinned a lot of things, but... One of the first dates with John was actually in Chicago. We went dumpster diving together, which is a Chicago tradition. I don't know if they lock dumpsters now, but and upcycling is so,
right.
I'm sure dumpsters are so picked over now, but you know, in the late 90s, boy, it was awesome. You could get so many amazing things to make art with, to live off from, to build, you know. So John and I, our first, you know, date, we were at a bar and had a refreshment. We come out and the house across the street was renovating. I'm like, oh my gosh, you see that dumpster? And we both crawled in. We're like, look at this. And we went home with a whole bunch of stuff. So obviously that's love at first sight. And then, we skinned an animal. That was pretty much date number two. So after that, what more could you do? I mean, it was a really, really...
So that was the precursor to your life now.
Right. I think we both realize that we look at the world in a very excited and unanticipated way that could open new doors for both of us if we came together as a team. So we basically moved to our location here in 1997. I was actually 9 months pregnant when we moved, and we had our first child here.
And you're... just south of Chicago.
We are. We're
in Indiana.
Yep. We like to say we're at the tip of the lake. If you look at a map, we really are at the. So we're about an hour and 20 minutes out of Chicago. So as you swoop around the lake, we love being here. It was difficult to find a place. Being both artists, both self-employed, driving a beat up pickup truck, nobody wanted to give you a loan. So we were able to get some family finance for the first few years to be able to build the farm and start. Farm is a big word. We like to call it a large homestead. We do a lot of things here, but the word farm in Indiana almost indicates a much larger expectation. And we do what we can, and we have extensive gardens now, and many things we do that talk about farming, but definitely not the farm word in Indiana. So
got it. So you have, like, over the years, I'm fortunate that my parents-in-law live just 45 minutes from you, so I've gotten to come once every 1 to 3 years. It's been wonderful to see the transformation of the place. So you've always had a house and a studio, but each of them have grown.
Yeah.
And you, I don't know, you have 2 kids now and grown kids almost.
Grown.
And your paper studio. Tell me about what
sure.
you do in your studio, the different
the
facets.
The studio has really developed. I mean, when we first moved here, I was teaching almost by then 3 classes at Columbia College in Chicago. So my income was being, that's where my income was coming from. So I focused a lot of my energy in that direction. John, being a studio potter, focused his energy. So his studio was built first. His studio was actually already here. It was a pole barn that's next to the house. And it was only really half of a space. And then we kind of, it's a 20 by 40 building, which is great, but half of it was only sort of outfitted as a shop. The guy that worked there before did small engine repair. So it had, you know, it had finished walls, windows, and a cement floor, and it could be studioized. The rest of it was all gravel and was mainly a garage. So we opened that up so he could extend his studio, and we built a couple wood-fired kilns. And then my studio came off the side of it. So we then just extended another 20 feet over, and slowly, you know, first it was a roof, and I was working mainly outside, mainly seasonal since I was teaching so much. And then eventually the walls came around, but not before someone offered me a Vandercook press. Uh-huh. We knew we were getting the press in March of the next year after snow had gone. So we basically poured a cement floor, and then that spring we moved in the press, and then we built the walls around the press,
okay.
and our studio came to be. And then everything in the studio has either been created by ourselves or found. It's amazing when people drive in your parking lot or your driveway, and you're like, oh, yeah, I do this, this, and this, and then you know, you don't see them for 5 months, and suddenly they drive in with a book press, and they're like, well, I had this in my basement, and can I swap? I was pressing flowers with it, and then we swap them a handmade mug for it. So a lot of the equipment is really, I've been very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time, just to let people know what I'm doing and looking for, and suddenly it just shows up. We've been very fortunate. The same with even building the studio. All the windows have been reclaimed from many houses around here, and so has the trees that are in my studio that build up, that are the beams, are ones that we have harvested off our own land. So we're trying to kind of pull from the environment a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that really made me start even thinking about the plants that I use for paper making, and that was the really early beginnings of how we're able to live in, in harmony with the land around us, and really influence. I also enjoyed plant paper, but I always felt that it was never made very well, and I think it's just people just don't dedicate the time that takes to really. It's difficult. It's hard to make. It's little return on a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many reasons why not to do it. So I thought, well, why don't I conquer this and see if it's really viable to make something like this? And the exchange has been really great. You know, we get wheat straw. We don't grow wheat straw, but I make paper from wheat straw. And the person I get the wheat straw from swaps a day in my studio. So we get 80 bales of wheat straw dropped in our barn in the fall, which helps bed our animals. I use, you know, maybe five of those bales in total for the whole year to make paper. And he comes for a day and makes paper. It's no effort for him to have 80 bales, and it's fabulous. There's a symbiosis. You know, it's the same with the hay that I also make a paper from hay, multiple grass fiber, and that's just as lovely. We actually bale hay with our neighbors for our goats, and thus some of that is a trade effort. It's not like we help them, they help us. Suddenly we both have enough food for our animals for the winter, and that then gets made in another bale that gets made into paper. All the twine that's around the bales is a sisal, it's a grass. After much research, I've decided that I could actually make it into a decent paper, and it has incredible capability for absorption, so it makes an excellent sumi paper. Mm-hmm. So I'm using that, and that paper in particular is interesting. I started using my twine. I started collecting my neighbor's twine, and come to find out, there's like three different kinds of twine in the world that come to Indiana. Uh-huh. There's natural, treated, and plastic. Well, plastic is obviously the cheapest, but unfortunately, most farmers will burn their plastic, and it's not recyclable in Indiana, so they're using an unrecyclable plastic. So my job was to convince my friends, the farmer friends around me at least, and any bale that we had in our barn, that it should all be this natural sisal. And it's pretty much just educating them a little bit about what they don't know, which, you know, that the plastic twine shouldn't even be used. And when they see that, it's actually more detrimental if it's in their field, because it gets locks into their equipment, and then realizing that, and then them burning it is not any better. So that was an issue. Once they went to, then there's a green twine, which is medicated with treated with a anti-mildew sort of agent. And that twine, you shouldn't even be touching because of what they're using on it. So it shouldn't have human touch on it. It shouldn't go in your compost pile, which it could if it was natural sisal. So once again, they're burning that or putting it in a compost pile, and it's actually leaching to the ground. So that was problematic. And then when I started talking to them about what the benefits of natural sisal, and that I would personally take it away from them, they realized that it was better that I would take it.
So are they actually, they're buying the sisal to bale their...
They're bale their own twine, their own hay and straw.
So you're really making an impact. So they've switched. Nice.
Not everybody's switching, and not every farmer will do it, but if I'm able to come and sweep and collect their twine, I've got three or four farmers who are now doing it, and that makes me happy, it makes them happy. They don't have, because mainly they're using that twine, they take it off and they pile it. Well, it becomes now byproduct for them, or a waste. So if they can have somebody who's actually going to remove it for them, they're much more happy, because they accumulate a fair amount for them, you know, to be in the way.
Right.
So I set up feed bags at their barns, and I just go collect it.
Nice.
And then so that comes back here. So I get the fiber, which is happy, and they're happy because they have a way to get rid of it in an efficient manner, and they realize that they're helping the environment. So that sort of thing is prevalent in all the papers that I try to make. So we have the wheat straw and the hay, the sisal paper. And then the giant ragweed is something that it's not necessarily helping in that way, but it does collect a lot of natural fibers that are on the roadside or that are being collected that are naturally just growing. It's not like I'm not using any sort of fossil fuel or anything way to transport them anywhere. I just go out my back door and there's a patch, and I'm able to harvest from that. So in a sense, our fibers are really trying to look at how we can harmoniously connect with the environment around us, as well as the people we're connecting with. And so it's more of a circle. We're trying to create that healthy place.
Right. That's great. And then you do a lot of decorative papers. You mentioned the suminagashi.
Yeah, I do some sumi. I do some marbling. I'm not a great sumi or marbling. A lot of the more decorative papers that I really like to make are the what I call the pulp imaging papers, where I'm using, I love cotton. I think cotton is one of these amazing malleable fibers that can just do anything and anything for you. And it can color well, it can, and then once beyond making paper, it can, you can glue it and tape it and bend it and process it, and it just is so malleable and strong, and it's amazing. So I like designing the surface to create unusual patterning or tessellation or some other unusual technique that will bring about who's ever using it, their design. The idea is to enhance someone else's design. Sometimes these papers are merely out of curiosity that I make, or they become part of my artwork, and then other people ask about them, and then they become part of the sample book that we have. So that's how a lot of those papers. And then there are the surface design papers, some marbling, some sumi, and some paste, which getting to understand paper surface has really come about more so by using those different processes and how my additives react to certain materials placed upon them, paste being different from sumi as well as Western marbling. So it's been it's constant sort of understanding what the material and the methods and the additives can do, and then servicing a bookbinder, an artist, really efficiently, because they can come to me and be like, well, I want to inkjet, and then I want to watercolor, and then I want to bind it, and then I want to glue something to it. And then the idea is, like, if I don't have something that kind of fits those things, we talk about shape, size, color, texture, and then even the life beyond that. You know, what is going to happen to your piece? Is it going to be handled? Is it going to go into a vault? Is it going to be, you know, used by a lot of people? You know, what sort of life does your piece need to have and this paper need to do? So there's a lot of interaction with that, which is a big part of the studio. It's been more of a bigger part because I do a lot of, I visit a lot of conferences where we, or gatherings where people are, I'm able to talk to people very intensely about the papers that they use. I've been a printmaker forever, so I understand a lot of commercial stock and what they can and can't do. And so we have the sort of understand, if they're saying they're using a particular kind of paper, I'm hoping that I have a relationship with that we can discuss that. And then mainly is we're discussing what it can't do for them, or and if handmade paper can be something that will help them or change the way that their piece will perform for them. And that's a really interesting conversation, because it really talks about, you know, the recipe of it, the making of it, the origin of it, how you can really tweak things to do, to, you know, perform exactly how you want them to perform.
Right. So let's just talk briefly about where people can find your papers. So you have a website, hookpotterypaper.com. And your papers are on there. And then you mentioned you go to several
gatherings. So there's the Dart Hunter Conference, the Guild of Bookworkers Conference. I always have stashes of paper at PBI. Or if I'm teaching out and about, I'll usually use social media to let people know if I'm in that part of the country. I'll be in Maine the end of August, and I will send a notice about where I am. And then if, you know, basically sometimes it's open enough where I can stop by or someplace. Or, you know, when I was traveling back from a conference across country, I had Emily Martin from Iowa, who knew I would be passing through her town, asked me to stop. And so the students, you know, I opened my car door, so to speak, and the students were able to pick and choose some sheets. So in a sense, it's, you know, letting people know of my travels, and if I am passing through town, I will make that happen.
Right. And you're really, you're also very good at working with artists, I think, because of your background and maybe some of the training at Dudonay, and that's another aspect that you of your business.
Yeah,
right? And you have a residency program.
We have residency. It's kind of a light residency.
Uh-huh.
Some people choose to stay, or if they're very local, they're off site either at their home or a neighbor's or a friend's or something to that effect. But You know, people can come to the studio with little or no experience or a lot, depending on what their project is. And it's a guided sort of day. So depending on that, usually there's conversation that takes before place, obviously, before that, whether, you know, if you have an idea, we work that out. If you don't have an idea, if you're like, well, I'm curious about this sort of, you know, paper making in this way, either I have classes, so if they want to go a class route just to sample that, or if they want to have private instruction, they can come and do that. Or if they're working on something in their work and they're like, I really want to understand pigmentation better, then they'll come and we have class time, so to speak. We talk about that, help them understand their questions, and then we work through a series of they work through some pieces and work out pigmentation so they really understand it, and then they do leave with obviously work that they've made. So it's really a one-on-one sort of what do you need the studio to do for you, and what sort of fibers are you interested in, and if you're not sure, I'm there to guide you, and if you are sure, I'm there to help you tweak what you need.
And it's tailored to the particular artist. Like, you, sometimes people come for a day, other people have come for a couple of weeks.
So, yeah, it's really varies. I've had people, typically we don't do a half day because paper process takes so long. But if someone's coming for a couple half days, that works out as well, too. But you really can't get anything done, as you know, Helen, in the paper studio, a half day. So it's really... it really works really well. I had a couple ladies here last Tuesday. They worked as a, they both have separate work, but they shared the day because they're friends and they can handle being in the same space together. Really, not everybody can share a space.
Right.
But they decided that that's a good time for them, actually. They see each other so little. They live in two different towns, so it was for them to be together and work, but yet work on their own thing. So it was a really, you know, it's a really wonderful experience for them to be able to be with their friend and work on their own individual ideas. So that's
cool.
Really awesome.
Okay, and I want to wrap up shortly, but I wanted to just ask your opinion about the future of hand paper making and what you, I mean, you've worked with a lot of students, any particular, you know, are some of them going on to do things? I don't know, I'm just curious.
Right. The future of paper, you know, it's really interesting. I think we're human and we really like tactile things. We need tactile things. We need beautiful pottery to touch and drink tea out of it. We need, and whether, and you know, I believe technology has its place, and it's also a fabulous tool. I mean, it's great. I can talk to somebody halfway around the world in 30 seconds and, you know, have this conversation. But when it comes right down to it, you know, there's nothing like that cup of coffee in the morning, that feeling. And so the tactile experience will never leave us. And if anything, handmade paper has become, even plain paper, most paper has become much more interesting to people because it's become now an object that they don't use as often maybe as they used to before. I think the surge of teaching hand, which I've watched and have been a part of, teaching hand paper making, has given artists another way to move in an efficient manner. And I mean, I guess what I mean by that is it's another medium that can, paper is very, I'm going to say easy to manipulate in a way that's probably simpler than bronze. It's much, a little bit more malleable. It gives, gives movement. It can, there's a lot, I think it's such a malleable material that it's an attractive future sort of endeavor for people to include. The few students I've worked with, graduate students at School of the Art Institute, paper has become anything from an installation to a book piece to a support unit to, it's just worked its way so many because it has such a diverse sort of ability.
Right.
And for them to see all those different ways it can work, they have their own ideas and they attach their needs to it. It, you know, it's, I just helped a student create these very large sheets that wouldn't have happened any other way.
Right.
I mean, it's there, so it opens a whole nother door of, I think, and paper is, in a sense, sometimes the simplistic choice.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of
mm-hmm.
responds exactly to what you want to do. It's lightweight, it's easy to carry, it's easy to install. I mean, it has these sort of attributes that make some things a lot more easy. It's dynamic, it can carry light, it can bounce light. So, if anything, I think it's going, and you know, the trend, which hopefully is not a trend, it's just what it's supposed to be, it's going to be green. You know, paper is a way to break something down and then build it back up, and then it can be recycled again. It's one of those things that can move, it's very timeless. So,
right. I liked your analogy when you just started this part of the conversation to drinking from a teacup that's handmade, and it made me start thinking, well, what would be, well, we say paper is obsolete. Well, if food became obsolete, if we were just taking a pill every day or getting a shot every day for our
nutrients.
Hopefully that won't happen. So the same with paper. It's exciting.
It's exciting
time for paper.
Right. I mean, think of it as it's a communication device. It is one of the,
right.
You know, I mean, if the caveman had paper, they would have been drawing those bison on paper, not on the cave wall, because it would have been flatter. They could have taken it with them
right.
on hunting trips, be like, this
right.
is what we're
right.
after. You know, so I think the thing is, because it's age old. It's been used so. Can you think of any art form that's older than the piece of paper? I mean, it really has been used as a substrate. It's that, you know, it's the thing hanging in the background. You wouldn't have a print without paper. You wouldn't have it. You know, there's so. It's just, and it being a medium in and of itself makes complete sense.
Yeah.
You know, and just that, you know, who doesn't pick up a handmade sheet of paper and just, it's just beauty.
Right.
It's just really beautiful.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's that, and it's that handmade quality, so to speak. It's like, you know, there are some machine-made papers, but those are, if you lay them next to a handmade sheet, it's that tactile quality of something that's been made by somebody else. And that warmth, that mark of human
mm-hmm.
endeavor, that
mm-hmm.
warmth of the sheet, it's there.
Yeah.
It carries that energy.
Right. Okay, I got to wrap it up. Got to get on to my next stop, Andrea. But thanks so much. It's great
Helen.
Talking to you.